And what I'm going to do is talk about, for maybe 10 minutes each, before I have questions and answers, you know, Q&A at the end, for about 10 minutes each on what I see as like some key places that modernity challenges any person who is religiously oriented, and a fortiori challenges the Catholic person to think more deeply about the faith, but also where these four challenges that come from the modern era, which are, you might say, secular challenges, all also perhaps invite Catholic answers or resolutions. So I want to begin with the first bullet point I have there on your handout, which is about Christocentricity. And I want to begin by just mentioning a gentleman who some of you may have read, and I hope all of you have heard of, that is to say, Gotthold Ephraim Lessing. Lessing is one of the great figures of the German Enlightenment, whose life spans from something like the 1720s to the 1780s. So he's writing around the time of the advent of the American Revolution and then eventually the French Revolution. And he wrote in 1779 a play that is called Nathan the Wise, in which there's a dialogue between that he purposefully anachronistically puts back in the time of the Third Crusade in the High Middle Ages between a rabbi, or actually a Jewish interlocutor named Nathan, a Muslim king, and or a Muslim prince, I should say, and a Templar Catholic crusader. In the midst of this dialogue between the three, there is a parable told, which is the famous parable of the rings. And in the parable of the rings, there is a king. The king represents God. And the king wants to give a precious ring to one of his three sons. He has three sons. The ring will promote the goodness and welfare of humanity and will bring lasting truth to the human race. But in his weakness and generosity, the king promises each of the sons, who represent, you might have guessed, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, to give them the true ring. So he has two rings fabricated that are exact replicas or close to it, such that no one knows which is the true ring, and he gives the three rings to the sons. The king then dies. The sons then become confused and quarrelsome among each other to figure out who has the true ring. You're starting to get the idea. Who has received the true revelation from the king that will bring prosperity to the world? There's even a rumor that there's a fourth ring that was the true ring none of the sons got, and they all have replicas. So maybe none of us got the true revelation. In the end, Nathan says that the way that the sons find resolution is to agree to live as if they each have the true ring by being generous, tolerant, prosperous, kind to the others, and in that way making the world a better place, so that they, while never knowing who has the true ring, try to outcompete each other to improve the world and its welfare and not to absolutize their own claims. This is, of course, totally contemporary. It's interesting how vivid this idea is in our age in terms of the question of Islamic absolutism, Catholic absolutism, Christian culture, post-Christian culture, and the claim to have absolute divine revelation. Now, Lessing also wrote another famous treatise called On the Spirit and the Letter, in which he called for the study of the New Testament as a purely historical document by human authors in a given time and place, the way we would study any other document historically. In other words, let's look at it, you might say, as a sociological artifact, the early Christian movement as an interesting religious tradition that emerges from Judaism at a given time and place. In short, let's explain the religious traditions by their historical, intra-worldly, sociological causalities, and really, in a certain way, reduce the explanation of their revelations to their cultural and anthropological settings in history. It's naturalization of historical claims to revelation. And he wants to promote an ethical universalism among the religions. This has become effectively a normative stance in our own time. You can just hear someone saying, "Father, you are wearing a very strange medieval costume. Don't you know it's been hundreds of years since anyone believed in an absolute religious revelation? What we understand today is that we have different symbolic traditions that all speak of the absolute, but that we all try to live them in ways that are tolerant and recognize that we may not have the truth. And thus the kind of, you know, typical agnostic stance towards absolute revelation. Well, I mean, I think that this mentality, which is often taken on for the sake of pragmatics, because we want political unity and tolerance and a soft edge to the way we commune with each other or interrelate to each other politically, as well as questions of historical skepticism, can we really know if anything's absolute, is a very powerful solvent in our own time and place. It also creates interesting enigmas for the modern person. Here's one. If I relativize all dogmas, in the end, can I really entertain the practice of any absolute religious commitment? It doesn't seem usually to follow that one can. But even more radically, what if we got rid of all the particular dogmas and creeds of the religions so that we could create mutual tolerance among the religions in the religious traditions of the world today? But that wasn't enough, because we still had other creeds and dogmas that were held by people who weren't religious. Then we need to have a powerful solvent to relativize those claims to truth, and so on. And you end up where, in fact, what guarantees you, supposedly, the terms of social unity is that you have a total solvent or a complete relativization of any epistemic commitment to absolute truth. Does that sound familiar to you? Anyway, the problem with that is you actually can't build social unity without commitments about basic goods that everyone in the social group is committed to, including especially important social political goods like justice, which is based on a notion of the dignity of the human person and what pertains to the dignity of the human person, universality of human rights, and so forth. So actually, although Nathan seems wise and Lessing seems quite enlightened and tolerant, he's also creating massive problems. Because in the end, absolutes are the condition for social unity and not an obstacle to it. The question is to get the true ones. The other thing is this. Human beings' religious desires don't actually go away. You know, we'll be enlightened. We'll get rid of the absolute dogmas. What happens then? Religion resurfaces. And in what form? Often rather irrational forms. It's not that the dogmas go away, it's that they become now reinstantiated, often in ways that Aquinas would call, Thomas Aquinas was a 13th century Dominican, would call superstitio, that's to say, irrational religion. And so you have to then think about what is the way to frame absolute commitments in ways that actually tend to make religion reasonable, healthy, and sane, as opposed to irrational and superstitious or dangerous. So the other problem, just most fundamentally, is human beings remain fundamentally interested in religious truth. They just don't give up on the question of whether God reveals himself to us. Catholicism has negotiated, this is my sort of first point of four, and here I'm turning toward where I think there's opportunities. Catholicism has negotiated this interesting challenge in modernity by claiming three important things about the, let's say, historical absolute disclosure of God in Christ, what I'm calling theologically Christocentricity, the centrality of Christ as a locus or place of absolute knowledge of God in history. The first is that we need not denigrate religions just because we don't believe that they have the last word or are in every way, if we believe they are not in every way true or true in every aspect, we need not denigrate them. So I've given you a text from Aquinas, which I'm not going to read on the handout, where he talks about the fact that religion is a natural dimension of the human person. And so it's not surprising that you find religion peppered or, you know, sprinkled throughout the entire human race and religious traditions emerging in lots of different ways. The Catholic Church in modernity has emphasized the inherent reasonableness of human beings being religious, but also the fact that often our religious behavior is wounded either by ignorance or selfishness or a kind of arbitrariness. So the Catholic Church says, is a lot of religious behavior arbitrary and relative? Absolutely. Is it for that reason something that's unnatural that should be abandoned? No. And there are deep and profound human truths in non-Christian religions that ought to be respected and, in fact, engaged with. But the second point is that the church has emphasized rightly in modernity that the engagement of historical reason matters. So actually, let's go back to the parable of three rings. What if we could figure out which ring was true by investigating who made the ring, what the markings were, and what the markings are on the rings that are currently being held? These so-called reasons of credibility, reasons of believability of the genuine validness of a religious tradition. So the church has emphasized in modernity the importance of the rational study of the history of Israel and the history of Christ. The history of Christ, the historical Jesus, his claims about himself, and the question of the physical resurrection of Jesus. And the church has argued that actually, when you investigate it reasonably and probe it with historical scrutiny, you see that Jesus of Nazareth was not a myth, that the high claims made by the church about Jesus are claims that originate with the historical Jesus of Nazareth himself, that the historical claim to the physical resurrection of Jesus has arguably a real grounding in history. The mystery of the faith cannot be proven by historical reason. You can't prove the church's claim that Jesus is God, become human, or that Jesus is physically raised from the dead, which is what the church proclaims as the heart of the gospel, that God has become human and that Christ in his human nature is raised from the dead. But you can show it's not a myth in the strict sense of a classical understanding of myth, a mythology. It really is a historical claim, and it cannot be disproven. In fact, there's a lot that actually suggests the rigor of historical logic coheres well or harmonizes with the faith when you study it historically. And the last thing is that the church has claimed in the modern world that the incarnation, that's the technical word for the idea of God becoming human in Christ, that Christ is God and man, that the incarnation is actually the solution that God has given to the human dilemma regarding absolute knowledge of God. Because if we are in fact naturally religious, and if we're really confused religiously, and we have these traditions that are in many ways very deep, and they suggest a deep human propensity to religion, but often carry elements that are problematic or arbitrary, then we need resolution from God to reveal himself to us in absolute terms. And that is what the revelation given to Israel and given to the church in the person of Christ claims to be. That God has become human so that we might literally see God as he is. As Jesus says in chapter, I think, 15 of John's gospel to the apostle Philip, "Philip, he who sees me sees the Father." And as he says in John 8, "I and the Father are one." So that's John 10. John 8 is "before Abraham was, I am." And Jesus makes these very high claims in the Gospels about his own identity as being an identity that in which he's one with God. And he manifests God in his own human life, death, and resurrection. Maybe this is an answer, in fact, to a plight or a problem that the parable of Nathan the Wise and our kind of modern pluralistic relativism brings to the forefront. That's the first idea. The second idea is I want to talk about the cosmos and the image of God. So this is really the problem raised by our terrific, vast explosion of knowledge about the physical universe and the origin of life, which has been given to us by the scientific revolution, which tells us a story, which in an abbreviated form goes something like this, that somewhere between 13.8 and 14.5 billion years ago, there was a very intense density of matter that basically expanded at a rapid rate in an action which is now termed the Big Bang, and that the universe has been expanding over a vast course of time, which we can actually measure the trajectory and in a certain way the kind of rate of by the use of modern physics, and that at a certain point, a stasis system occurred in the solar system we inhabit, whereby life could emerge in the form of single-celled bacteria approximately 5 billion years ago. I think it's 5, maybe it's 4. And that over time, you had multicellular organisms arise around 3 billion years ago, and eventually complex warm-blooded mammals, animals with sensate knowledge that could learn through memory systems and develop tool making, and then eventually you had the emergence of human culture, distinctively human, you might say rational creatures, at least, it seems, 50,000 years ago, because we start to see evidences of human culture through paleontology, in which we see art and sophisticated religion, and eventually written language. Okay. And so a certain kind of, then, I would call it adjacent philosophy, a materialist philosophy, attaches itself to that. It's represented by people whose names we all know, like Dawkins, but in another way, Stephen Hawking, and any number of other high-ranking scientists who consider themselves atheist materialists, who would say that now we know that classical metaphysics, which explains the world in light of God, the Creator, is no longer necessary or even in a certain way relevant, precisely because we can explain the world sort of comprehensively through the knowledge given through the modern sciences. Now, that is surely a naive and philosophically problematic claim, or so I would say. And I think most analytic philosophers who are atheists today would be pretty quick to say that that's a all too simplistic resolution of the question. I think, in truth, there's a way in which, on the contrary, modern science is metaphysically parasitical, by which I mean, when you do this kind of modern cosmological story and you study the world scientifically, you presuppose a lot of metaphysical realism. By metaphysics, I mean the study of the being of things, the being, truthfulness or intelligibility, unity and multiplicity, goodness and evil in things, beauty and ugliness, the classic metaphysical questions, right? Being, unity, truth, goodness, beauty, and their privations. The reason it, so if it's parasitical, in fact, what happens is it's sort of like a cartoon where you're trying to run away from the villain, and every time you open a door in the house, you run into him again. And so that's, in a way, what's happening with Dawkins and company. Every time they try to find a new solution to the explanation of reality that would allow them to escape classical questions, lo and behold, there's the classical questions are there again. And why do I say that? Well, for the following reasons. You can't get away from the really core problem of why there is a world. And the more you study it, the more strange it becomes, because science shows you how alien it is to your preconceptions. People used to think that the sun goes around the earth, and it was the Copernican revolution that had actually kind of spiritual effects on people when they realized that they're not the center of the solar system, certainly not the center of the universe, physically and spatially, right? So there's a jarringness to the objectivity, but the objectivity then creates a sort of strange recognition of the fact that I didn't create reality with my mind, and it was there before me. And so the objectivity of the world, where the earth is going around the sun, and the sun is somewhere way far from the Big Bang, and all that stuff, is it confronts you with fundamental questions of existence. You also have a story scientists tell about how you get from one, you might call, level of being to another. I mean, the scientists are interested in the emergence of living things. And in the living things, they're interested in the emergence of human beings. So there is a kind of narrative that they inevitably tell you about how you move from material non-living things to material living things to human things. And that's gradations of reality. They don't really get away from gradations of reality. I think there's also just the fact that there's intelligible order in the world, which no matter how much you document the history of random chaotic events, or let's just say unforeseen, felicitous or infelicitous contingent events of history, you always run up against order. But because science presupposes order, you can't have explanation if you don't have order. So if you're seeking scientific explanation, you're presupposing and, in fact, dependent upon order, and you're unveiling order. So the more you unveil order, the more you raise the question of transcendent mind. And just lastly, because the more we explain a human being biologically, especially the neurological explanations, the more we raise questions about the reality and meaning of human freedom, human reason, human purposes. Are we just random collections of particles, or does our human life have a deeper meaning and purpose? So, the Catholic Church just has two classic ideas that are very helpful for navigating all this and showing the deep compatibility of modern science and classical metaphysics. The first is this: the idea of God as creator as primary cause, and the world as being a world of causes that we call secondary causes. And the idea is very simple. God gives being to all things, not just sometime in the past or sometime in the future, but at all times, now, he sustains in being all that is. So everything that exists depend upon the Creator to give it its very existence. And secondly, then, by virtue of that fact, everything that exists can be its own cause of other things happening. You and I are causes of things. We open doors. We read books. We write exams or essays. We talk to other people. We do good deeds. And we make changes in the world. And so is the case for all other things in our world of limited, finite, physical creatures. Well, this means that if God is sustaining us and all other things in being as the primary cause of being by being the creator of all that exists, and those beings themselves have their own intra-creaturely history, then there can be this vast, you might say, tableau, painting, expanse of the universe on which the whole story unfolds, and it can incorporate all kinds of supposedly chance or random events. We could talk maybe in the Q&A about what chance is, but it basically always depends upon some degree of order in things. Because when two lines of causality interact by chance, like you meet a friend at the grocery store, you weren't presupposing that you would, it happened by chance. The fact of the matter is there were still two ordered patterns of behavior. You were going to the grocery store in an ordered way, and so was the friend. And that is the case also with regards to genetic mutations. That's the case with regards to random natural selection. That's regards to the case with contingent events in the history of Big Bang cosmology. There's always lines of causal order there. So you can actually have it all. You can have your cake and eat it too. And in fact, in a certain way, you must have your cake and eat it too, because the very existence of the things with their kind of physical history in the cosmological world we live in calls to mind the question of whether there's an absolute cause of their very being, because they're all contingent things, and contingent things still don't explain themselves. And metaphysics has been proclaimed dead many times and always prematurely. It always lives. The question of why the world exists is real, and it's answered best by the answer that is God, the Creator, sustaining it in being. The second key idea is the idea of the spiritual soul as the form of the body. This is an idea from Thomas Aquinas. And this is really an idea that if you want to have a bad guy here, it's not materialists like Dawkins, it's Descartes. Descartes thinks that your spiritual soul and your body are two things, two substances, accidentally connected. Actually, he thinks in the pineal gland. We'll forgive him that strange scientific idea from his century. But the point is that you and I are not one being, we're two. We've got the ghost in the machine. That's the Cartesian phrase. The ghost is one thing and the machine is another. And it's all too odd a view of the human soul. The Catholic Church teaches, following Aristotle and Aquinas, the soul is the form of the body. So our irreducibly spiritual elements, intellect and free will, what makes us different from the other animals, what comes directly from God, the spiritual soul created immediately by God, so the Catholic Church teaches, as a truth of faith and reason, that the spiritual soul's intellectual and free capacities can be demonstrated by reason to be immaterial. Okay, I'm not going to try to argue that here, but I'm just going to affirm that it can be argued. I mean, I write about that myself elsewhere, and I can direct you to things. But the point is that the fact that we have intellect and will doesn't mean that we're two substances, but that the intellectual free creature in us is an animal, and that the spiritual soul is the form of the body, meaning I am one being, body and soul. So I am a rational animal. I am a free, deliberative, spiritually loving animal. Or another way to put it is I'm a physical body, a living physical animal who is also spiritually free and rational and capable of abstract universal thought, and capable of spiritual activities that can't entirely depend on the body, like universal conceptualization, deliberative free will, art, language, prayer, and lots of other things which aren't found in the other animals. The third topic I want to turn to is the question of the ethics of happiness. Now, we all know the Catholic Church is certainly the enemy of human freedom and is the wolf stalking the poor innocent lamb of modern human spontaneity and happiness and freedom and deliberative whim, and that we all should live without the constraints of morbid Catholic dogma. I always think of that beautiful image in the film A Room with a View, where the young man, who's the 19th century English romantic, climbs a tree outside of Florence and is shaking the tree and screaming, "Beauty, truth, goodness." Anyway, it's a wonderful romantic image, kind of again. The sort of dour Victorian Anglican pastor is looking at the father of the young man. He says, "What is he doing? He's crazy." And he says to him back, he's shouting out his creed. It's this wonderful image of 19th century romanticism vis-a-vis stuffy Anglicanism. Anyway, but actually there are deep paradoxes in our modern liberal society. It is true that there's a lot of there's a concern for unconstrained freedom and what we might call, what modern philosophers sometimes call, freedom of indifference. That actually also stems from Descartes' idea of freedom. The freedom to do neither this nor that, or but to do whatever I wish. Real freedom is freedom from constraint for Descartes, as opposed to Aristotle, who thinks the deepest dimension of freedom is freedom for excellence, the freedom to be able to do something well. So let me just talk a little bit about freedom for excellence for a moment, give you one example so it's a little clearer. Let's say I want to have I go to a violin concert and I watch a fellow student at Williams play the violin well. I saw someone playing it actually early in the chapel who was exquisite. And I think, oh, I'd like to be able to do that. And then I go and I pick up a violin and it makes the most catastrophic sounds. And then I realize this is going to take a very long time. And then I apprentice myself to a teacher and I put myself under them and I practice for 3 hours a day, and things that sounded like shrieks begin to sound sonorous. And eventually I start to make beautiful violin music. And I now have the freedom to perform or to make beautiful music on the violin. Okay, that's hard to do. That's a disciplined regime. You're doing that all the time in your studies, right? Trying to acquire a kind of freedom for excellence in your own discipline so you can, you know, understand and articulate your discipline well and freely. Okay. The problem with just having a freedom of indifference that isn't also concerned from freedom for excellence in the moral domain is it creates a kind of a paralysis in human beings with regards to happiness. So what if being happy is not really much easier than playing the violin, right? So what we think is this. In work, if the artistic intelligence or the work intelligence, we need to really discipline ourselves and be very serious students and learn. But with regards to morality and like the pursuit of human happiness, well, that really will just come to us spontaneously by following our intuitions, whims, and instincts, and it will all work out. The problem is it doesn't really all work out. We do break our face. You know, we hit obstacles. Things go wrong. Moral catastrophes occur. And human happiness does not ensue. This may not be evident to you in your 20s. It will become so. As someone who works a lot with young adults in Washington, D.C., I would tell you, I can assure you, it will become so soon if it hasn't dawned on you yet. You will either know people who are cautionary tales or you will become one yourself. In fact, becoming happy is a lot more like learning to play in a jazz quartet. I have a friend who's a moral theologian. He always uses this image. To play jazz looks like they're being spontaneous and they're being very free, but actually it requires an immense amount of knowledge. To be able to transposition with a whole group of other people in impromptu settings means you can move very fluidly from one, you know, key to another, or transpose very fast from one rhythm to another. To do that, you have to already know the basics extremely well, know scales extremely well. The life of happiness is the same thing, actually, analogously. You have to be able to have some capacity for the classical virtues of justice, prudence, fortitude or courage, and temperance, to be able to kind of live out under, you might say, to live out the regime of excellence in your soul, so that when new situations arise, you can be mobile and adapt. But instead of playing jazz, for Thomas Aquinas, the heart of Christian happiness is to be able to love. And that is actually really hard. Anyone who thinks it's easy to love is very naive or very arrogant. The truth is, it's very hard to love. And it requires a tremendous amount of disciplined intelligence and prudence to work at the justice of love and the temperance of love. That's the self-control of the sense appetites. The fortitude and courage to love in difficult circumstances, and the prudence to love intelligently. And you see this all the time in your adult life. You go to somebody, I mean, people come to me with these questions all the time. I don't always have the answers to them. But, you know, so they say to you, well, listen, if I don't go home for Thanksgiving to see my family, that will be seen as, you know, gravely unloving. If I go home to see my family for Thanksgiving, I will see this uncle and I will see this sibling, and these issues will rise, and this fight will ensue, and this catastrophic fissure, which already exists in the family, will be accentuated. What do I do? How do I live out love prudently? Do I go to Thanksgiving or not go to Thanksgiving? It's a very simple, typically American example. But life confronts you with many such examples, and so to acquire the kind of wisdom, prudence is practical wisdom, the kind of practical wisdom to live out a disciplined form of love and become free to be spontaneously loving in each and every circumstance, to adjust to it, is the kind of methodological kind of discipline of the soul that we need. We actually need that structure. And then authorities come in to help us learn how to do that and to shape our decision-making so that we can live lives of wisdom and love. That's what Catholic morality is actually about. If you read Thomas Aquinas and St. Augustine, it's very profound. And in our world, where often people have every opportunity to attain material goods immediately by pushing a button on Amazon, but actually finding happiness difficult in terms of relationships, job fulfillment, life wisdom, a plan and course of action which they find satisfying, a community they like to be a part of. This kind of traditional wisdom is very helpful for finding happiness. And the Catholic Church has this well of wisdom about happiness that's really deep and is of great importance for us today. The last thing I want to talk about is the sacramental society. The mantra, it's a simplistic mantra, and I presume that many of us might not use it, but it does denote something helpful, is the idea that today people would rather be spiritual but not religious. That's a very interesting phrase. I think that must mean at least this, that to be spiritual but not religious means to believe that there is some awe-filled mystery at the heart of the universe. Maybe it's personal, maybe it's impersonal, some transcendent mystery of beauty and goodness that is present in all things, but that we ought never to try to approach it just through the constraints of a particular dogma, dogmatic system, way of thinking or understanding from one particular tradition, nor ought we to be part of any physical body of people who have a set of rote practices that will hem us in one particular discipline or form of worship. So there's a kind of raw individuality present in the idea of being spiritual but not religious. Because to be religious is really, I think, in the end, to be creedal and to be liturgical. If you're creedal, you follow certain kinds of dogmas or notions, ideas, doctrines, call them whatever you want, principles, ideas about the sacred. And if you're liturgical, you participate in sacred liturgy of some kind, in some religious tradition, with others, to discipline your soul to approach the absolute. The paradox of that is, of course, that the only way an animal, and we are all animals, can approach God with any other person is through these doctrinal and liturgical forms, be they in the Eastern religious traditions or the Western. So to be a spiritual animal who has a community of people with whom you live out your religious yearnings or desires, you say spiritual yearnings or desires, and to do so with other people requires these frameworks. Modernity, you know, one of the great strengths of modernity is the enormous accentuation of individual autonomy. I mean, in a certain way, I'll tell you the truth, I'm not, in fact, a great admirer of Luther. I'm critical of Martin Luther's theology, and I don't think that his solution he offered the church was constructive. And, in fact, I think it was in many ways destructive and divisive. I also have a lot of friends who are Protestant and participate in Protestant Catholic ecumenism in great depth. But I do think that you have to say that whatever you think about Luther's theology, sociologically, his radical autonomy to challenge the medieval institution of the church and to stand before every one of the 39 articles and et cetera, it marks a radical break in the history of Western and European thought towards deep accentuation of individualism. that is in a way become de facto the starting place of the modern person. From Luther to Descartes, Descartes casting under suspicion everything that he's received from tradition and trying to rethink everything from himself through Cartesian certitudes as a philosopher. This kind of radical individualism is part and parcel of us. We're bored by it. We've been raised in it. It's like it's easy. We all got that. And I think that what you will see, and I think what we're going to see increasingly in our own capitalist society, which is very marked by individualist competition, market economy, and growing alienation, which is destructive, in fact, often of the family unit and of living organically in one place. You know, we can take an airplane across the country or the world and get a new job somewhere else. And it fractures and individualizes us in many ways, the modern individualistic ethos allied with a kind of capitalist market economy, is that we see that human beings have become beings often tormented by solitude. And so spiritual but religious is also an opportunity, because actually human beings do need communion. They need communion. Union with. That's what it means in Latin, communio, to be united with other people and with God. And actually in that sense, liturgy and doctrine and the disciplines of the soul that they represent teach the radically religious animal in us to live in spiritual communion with God and others in a communio, in a communion. And the beautiful thing about Catholicism is it does that not by centering us around a guru or the smartest person who can talk to us the best about the mystery of God as best they understand it, but around sacraments. The sacraments are physical signs and instruments of the presence of God given to us by Christ himself to draw us into communion, not around our own charismatic personalities, but around God and around Christ. So they're cathartic. They create community in which everything is displaced from being centered on ourselves towards being centered on God, but therefore God makes space for everyone. There's nothing more universalistic and inclusive than God, because he's the author of all things. And there's no one more inclusive than Christ, because he's the savior of all things. And the grace of Christ present in the sacraments permits this fragile, wounded, individual, modern person to find deep and lasting, meaningful communion with God and with other human beings. So I've given you four topics there where I think the Catholic Church faces challenges, but also radical opportunities in our 21st century. And I'm grateful for your attention, and I'll now open the floor to questions. And there are no bad questions or challenges or requests for clarification. Yes, sir. You in the Batman shirt.
So I'm curious as to the challenges the church faces. Is there a history of the church facing, evangelizing, or confronting nihilism to the degree that we see it in today's society?
That's a great question.
And if so, is there a solution that the church has or the church has to it?
Well, so I'll tell you a little bit of, I'll indulge a little bit in autobiography. I went to Brown University in the 1990s and was not Catholic or baptized. And so our church fathers were Michel Foucault and Jacques Derrida and André Gide. And I was introduced into, I'd say, deep fried in 20th century French critical theory, and if I can call it this, metaphysical nihilism. And I didn't just become Catholic because I needed something stable to hold on to or some kind of cheap Freudian explanation, but it raised questions to me about whether there are foundations for truth in reality. And that did, in part, lead me to be interested in classical metaphysics. This is something for me that's very vital to have a kind of reflection on. And what I discovered, though, in terms of answering your question, is that in the 20th century in France, all the questions were on the table from the 1910s onward. And so actually, running all through French Catholic intellectual life, from the beginning of the 20th century all the way through, you find a deep engagement in the question of modern nihilism. And one of the key figures in that, not the only one by any means, but one of them is Jacques Maritain, the great French philosopher. You know, Maritain was himself raised non-religiously, and his wife, Riza Maritain, who was a Russian Jew, the two of them were in studying the Sorbonne in the 1910s and were quite deeply affected by what they took to be the positivism, the materialism, and the nihilism of the university at the time. And they took a walk in the left bank of Paris and sat on a famous park bench. Well, it's now famous because of this, a park bench in one of the main parks. And they made a suicide pact that if they didn't find meaning in their life, within 1 year they would kill themselves together because they found the current regime unbearable. And that, it was interesting, but then they, well, actually soon after that, they met and took classes with Henri Bergson, who was Jewish, but had an idea of a kind of religious horizon to human existence in his philosophy. And then they met the poet, the Catholic poet Léon Blois, and from him they learned about John of the Cross. And they ended up becoming Catholic, and then actually subsequently discovered Thomas Aquinas. And so this idea is in Maritain's writings throughout his life. He actually met with Gide personally and tried to convert him, and wrote a lot about Sartre. He's got a book called Existence and the Existent, which is a direct kind of engagement with Sartre's, what he takes to be Sartre's nihilism. And Étienne Gilson, who was a colleague of Maritain's and a writer in the Sorbonne, also writes in engagement using Aquinas with Heidegger, and wrote a beautiful book called Being and Some Philosophers that takes Aquinas' metaphysics to engage with this. There's a book that's just out, and I can give you the exact title and reference afterwards, by an excellent Italian Thomist. It's just been translated in English. His name is Possenti. Possenti, I think. And it's on Thomism and Nihilism. It's the best thing I've read, comparing Aquinas and Nietzsche. And the analysis of Nietzsche in that is fantastic. I'd highly recommend that book. Your library may or may not have it, but they might order it for you. But in any case, it's worth owning. It's a very good engagement with nihilism. He's tracing the genealogy of nihilism, especially from Nietzsche to Vadimo, and then trying to look at Thomistic responses. And so I could give you some more book recommendations about that. I think Edward Faeser right now, who's writing, he's an analytic philosopher, Feser. Edward Faeser, who's writing right now a lot of kind of excellent apologetic books that show the sort of vitality of Aquinas' metaphysics and the realism of them, is in his own way also responding to this issue. But I would say, yeah, the church has definitely grappled with it deeply in the 20th century. And a lot of times as Americans, we don't recognize that. Because our own intellectual tradition has been maybe up to now sheltered more from direct exposure to the glaring light of nihilism. But you look at another, just one more name to mention is Georges Bernanos, a French novelist in the 20th century, his whole project is to write a kind of deep Catholic literary, he's a novelist, writes beautiful literary responses to the problem of 20th century French nihilism. So I would say those are just some suggestions, but I'd say there's a lot of resources there. Yes, sir.
You mentioned earlier Descartes and the idea of the ghost in the machine, that human beings are these two different things at the same time. And so the response of the Catholic Church is that we're not a ghost inside of the machine, but the, I think your phrase was the soul is the form of the body, or maybe it was vice versa.
The soul is the form of the body, yeah.
So how does the immortality of the soul fit into that understanding of the human person? Mm.
Yeah, well, okay, I should first say, I should distinguish between Catholic dogma or doctrine and then particular schools of thinking. So I'm a Thomist. Thomas Aquinas was a Dominican. I teach Thomas Aquinas' thought, and I don't just believe it because they feed me as long as I teach it. I really actually think he's quite adept. But there are a lot of other treatments of the soul in the Catholic tradition. So it's not like there's just one hegemonic view, and there's plenty of actual disagreement and argument. And there are more Cartesian folks in the Catholic Church, to be sure, who we would call some kind of dualists. But the Church does teach that we are one concrete being, body and soul. I'm going to give you a little bit of what Aquinas does to answer the question, having stipulated that this is not the Catholic answer, but one way of doing things. Aquinas is going to argue from operations of both the intellect and the will that are thinking and willing cannot simply be material processes. So it is true that we have sensate representations. You know, you and I imagine things, and when we use words or language, we use sounds. And this is part of our animality, and we could probably study the parts of the brain that are being engaged when we are imagining things, memorizing things, making sounds. But on a deeper level, we're thinking universally in terms of concepts that aren't just identical with the sounds. Because after all, you and I could say the same things or say something very similar, communicate the same propositions and ideas in a different language, and people do all the time. So there's some capacity for universal thinking that isn't just our imaging and our language per se. That capacity for universal deliberation and reflection has immaterial elements. And so likewise, our deliberation by which we make free will acts isn't just determined by sensate goods. Like you put chocolate in front of me, and then you put, I don't know what, you know, red wine, and then I'm just paralyzed because I can't choose. I have sensate memories of both, and you know, which one is the animal going to choose? I can deliberate, and I could say, for example, well, you know what? I like both of them very much. I have a pretty strong opinion about which one's more important in life, but the truth of the matter is I'm on a diet right now. I'm going to abstain from either. I can do that because I have free will, and I can deliberate about possibilities abstractly and universally. So Aquinas is going to go down that road and look at both intellectual life and free will choosing and love, free spiritual love, and see that these are, say, there's immaterial elements. Then he's going to say, these operations require a substrate. They are grounded in a unified being. I am and you are unified human beings that are also doing other things that are vital operations that are more material, like digesting or seeing, that depend on the body. So I'm doing both things that are more materialistic and immaterialistic, and it's all coming from one subject. So these immaterial things are being grounded in a principle. Now, could I have immaterial operations grounded in a purely material principle? No. And he's going to give you lots of good arguments for why you can't say that. So you couldn't say, like, well, I'm a really deep down a material substance, completely extinguishable at death and totally material and corruptible, but I happen to have these immaterial operations like thinking and willing. Mm-mm. If you have immaterial operations of thinking and willing, they're grounded in a principle that's itself immaterial, but it's the form of a material body. So that's why I can actually control a lot about my physical bodily actions of nutrition, reproduction, seeing, not seeing, acting or not acting physically, because of the spiritual free will and spiritual free thought that inhabit me as a spiritual agent. And then he's going to argue, since these are immaterial principle, this is an immaterial principle, with these immaterial operations, it's not corruptible by death, and it subsists after death. The problem is, it's good to be a spiritual animal, body, and soul, so losing your body is not a good thing. So a soul without a body still exists. It's still personal. There's personal immateriality and immortality, but there's incompleteness. And he's going to say that doesn't prove that God needs to, doesn't prove there's a resurrection from the dead, but it does create an enigma for the philosopher. Like, why would you have spiritual souls that live on after death and not have bodies? And he says, you know, reincarnation does not make sense in one respect because you don't retain the same personal identity if you reincarnate, but we would have to retain the same personal dignity if we're a personal soul. But it does make sense in another sense to say people would reincarnate because people need bodies. That's part of what it is to be a human being. He says, so until you get the revelation of the resurrection from the dead, it's hard to make sense of the human condition. The resurrection from the dead actually makes a lot of sense of what it means to be a spiritual soul awaiting a body. So it's kind of delicate the way he handles all that. And it's, you know, there's lots of disputable sides of it. But he is going to argue for immateriality of the soul and personal immortality, but also the incompleteness of the soul without the body. I'm giving very long answers. I'll liberate you soon. I'll take one or two more questions. Yes, sir.
I have a question in regards to the ordering of the universe as God being the primary cause and then creating us humans being the secondary cause of certain natural phenomena.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, how exactly does chance, such as genetic mutations, mm-hmm. etc., which you mentioned, plays into a factor?
Can God work through chance? If God exists, can God work through chance? If chance exists, can there really be a God? Can there be order in the universe if there's chance, etc.? Okay. Actually, I think the person who deals with this best is Aristotle in the Physics, the book on his book on the philosophy of nature, where he, I mean, this is interestingly not even a Christian document, and he's just looking at the question whether, so do chance events occur? And if chance events occur, is the order of the universe ultimately undermined, or is there a kind of a provisionality of the order, but the deeper dimension of the universe is chaos? And he gives interesting answers. He says, so first thing he says is, there are things that happen by chance if you define it rigorously, which is to say you have different lines of order in the universe, and they don't necessarily predict their engagement with others. So you have one atom spinning through the universe, you have another atom spinning through the universe. And if you take one of those atoms and you look at it, like in terms of, you know, microphysics, you can create pretty predictive models of what's going on and where it's going and why it's going there, and then the other one. But then the two collide is not predictable just by knowing a lot about the causal linear likelihoods with regards to either of the two causal lines. Okay, so in that sense, chance is something that happens in a causal agent outside of, you might say, the intentionality of the agent. Intentionality here, understood in a broad sense, not in terms of intelligence, but just like what its ordering function or pattern is. And so similarly, you know, with gene recombination, I mean, you couldn't have genetic recombination if you didn't have a kind of ordered sequence in which the chromosomes interact in genetic and predictable genetic patterns and ways. Otherwise, we'd never be able to understand what's going on in genetics. It'd just be chaos all the time. There's an ordered sequence, but within that ordered sequence, there's random events that can happen in which things that are outside, as it were, the causal line of predictable pattern emerge that are chaotic or at random contingent events. So chance exists in that sense, something happening outside a particular line of causality. Does that do away with deep order? Does that do away with deep order? And Aristotle says, no, it can't, because chance events can only occur to physical agents of a given natural kind. Now, that means chance events occur in, for example, a chromosome of DNA, or to particular chemicals, or to particular atomic entities, or to human beings, or to kangaroos, or to supernovas. So there are natural kinds. The scientist always trades in analysis of natural essences or kinds of things. Helium is not hydrogen, is not water, is not, you know, whatever, uranium. And so the study of these things means you're always looking at a kind of, where you have a natural kind, you'll have ordered behavior. So you're always going to find deep patterns of order where you have natural kinds, and you have to have natural kinds to have chance events. Now, what Aquinas will come in is he'll say, okay, yeah, this is good. This is explaining reality. The thing is, if all of this is being sustained in being by God, who is causing it to exist in all of its details, then from our point of view, things are happening by chance, really, but they can, in principle, be governed by God from above. Now, you say, well, okay, so now you're saying there's like this really deep order that's in the chance behavior that God's like interested in. Hold on, I didn't say he's interested in everything. There could be God could have a lot of junkyard in the cosmos. I mean, there could be a lot of places where he's just not interested in high degrees of order and pattern. And it could be that there are places he's interested in more. And he does give the universe a lot of its own, it has its own kind of integrity, and a lot of that integrity is the way things, from our point of view, haphazardly unfold. So it's not necessarily in God's best interest to, as it were, enforce on us to approach him by being so evident that we are obliged to serve like slaves rather than as sons. So there's also an interesting question about how evident God wants to make himself. But the point is, I think in terms of sustaining the universe in being and working through chance events, there's not really a problem. It's not necessarily a reason to... I'm not really making an argument for the existence of God based on chance. But actually, if you start to go down that road, you could start to make an argument because you say, well, Yeah, the more I force the chance as the explanation, the more I see it does presuppose some kind of natural laws that are written into things on the level of physics and biology. Where does that intelligibility come from? And why are these contingent things there at all? And then you can start to make classical metaphysical arguments. I don't think going down the road of chance will allow you to just simply get rid of the deep metaphysical questions and thereby avoid the question of the possibility of the existence of God. All right, well, listen, why don't I stay and answer questions if people want to follow up with me personally, but I really thank you for all your kind attention. Thank you.